Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1321, The Assassination of John Lennon. This is being recorded on February 23rd of the year 2024. Before we get into the main body of the program, I want to encourage listeners to visit the Food for Thought post that is at the top left-hand corner of the SpitfireList.com website for information about upcoming programming policy, etc. Also, at the top of each written for the record description and at the top of each Food for Thought post, there are a number of important links. One of those links will enable you to subscribe to the podcasts that are being made by sister station WFMU and increasingly in our smartphone dominated landscape, podcasts are indeed the most convenient way for listeners to digest the program. So if you are one of those, sister station WFMU is podcasting For the Record. And again, there is a link at the top of each written For the Record description and each Food for Thought post that will enable you to subscribe to those podcasts. Also, there is a link again at the top of each written For the Record description and at the top of each Food for Thought post that will enable you to obtain the 32-gigabyte flash drive with all of my work printed and audio on it, including a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. This is available for a very small, nominal, tax-deductible fee. I get no money whatsoever from that. And the current flash drive is current as of, For the Record, 1310. And again, I am extremely pessimistic about the future. I basically do not think that we as a species are going to make it. And I think that those of you who are concerned about the future would do well to get a hold of that flash drive. At a minimum, that will enable you to explain, at least by using the material on that flash drive, what happened. Why did things go south? And boy, are things going south. Again, I get no money whatsoever from that. Perhaps that could be seen as proof positive that my worst critic's assertion, which is that I am nuts, is perhaps well-founded. At any rate, we will be talking about the assassination of John Lennon in this program. We are going to be relying for our information on an essay that was in Covert Action magazine of December 8th of 2023. It was by Jeremy Kuzmarov, K-U-Z-M-A-R-O-V, the editor of Covert Action magazine, and it's called What Three Letters of the Alphabet Link John Lennon's Murder to the Murders of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, and those three letters are CIA. In a nutshell, some of the key points of the article. Lennon was killed by four bullets that came in from the left. They struck him in the left side of his body. Chapman, Mark David Chapman, the alleged assassin, I think Patsy, and so does Kuzmarov, was on his right side. There was a man standing on the left of John Lennon, and that was the doorman Jose Sanjenis Perdomo. He was an anti-Castro sniper who was part of the CIA's Cuban exile invasion of Cuba. And in pre-Castro Cuba, Perdomo had been a chief of police under the regime of Carlos Prio Sequeira and Florencio Batista. He also allegedly coordinated a CIA assassination squad in Cuba and was also allegedly the control officer that the CIA assigned to Frank Sturgis when Sturgis joined the CIA in 1958. I would note that Lennon was the focal point of a number of different attempts by officialdom, both in this country and in the UK, to basically neutralize him one way or another. And I would also note that Perdomo was chatting for about 6 hours with Mark David Chapman while Lennon was at a recording studio working on a new album. And one of the police, one of the eyewitnesses, stated that Perdomo was the one who allegedly did the shooting. And it also is more than a little interesting that there were no fingerprints found on the gun. Perdomo brought it up and took it to a storage area. No fingerprints were taken from the weapon, although they did take fingerprints from the copy of Catcher in the Rye that Chapman had. Apparently, according to the official version, Chapman shot Lemon from 25 feet away. That was a feat of marksmanship that most observers feel Chapman was incapable of achieving. And the notion that Chapman did this to basically generate publicity for himself is negated by the fact that he did not apparently want to talk to the press from the start. He could have escaped because it was a subway station very nearby, but he made no attempt to escape. He simply waited for the arresting officers to come and arrest him. There are also evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of the shooting of Ronald Reagan, then Vice President, former CIA Director George H.W. Bush. I've spoken about those and about links. There are links between Mark David Chapman and John Hinckley. And I would also note that both Bernard Diamond and another MKUltra-linked CIA-linked hypnotist visited Mark David Chapman in prison. That was a guy named Milton Klein. And we're going to take a look at all of these things in detail right now. That is a brief summation of some of the key points of information. Also, there is an allegation that Yoko Ono was involved with the assassination, as Kuzmarov points out. An author does present information that points in that direction. He does not prove that. I would note that I have long wondered about Yoko Ono and her links to John Lennon, because she is the great-granddaughter of the founder of the Yasuda Trust. That is one of the great zaibatsu, the four giant family trusts that dominated the Japanese economy and are inextricably linked with U.S. big business and U.S. big capital. Time permitting, we will go into that. I've spoken about that, about the Yasuda Trust and the zaibatsu in many programs, including, for the record, program number 905. I will put a link to that. Now, reading from this article, once again, what three letters of the alphabet link John Lennon's murder to the murders of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, by Jeremy Kuzmarov, K-U-Z-M-A-R-O-V. And this is from Covert Action Magazine from December 8th of 2023. Another historian says those three letters are CIA, and even more, that Lennon was betrayed by Yoko Ono. Far-fetched? Before you scoff, look at the evidence this respected professor has finally decided to release after sitting on it for 41 years. The 60s era officially ended just before 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on December 8th, 1980. That is when former Beatles member John Lennon, a major voice of the era's social movement who wrote the peace anthems Imagine and Give Peace a Chance, was shot and killed just outside the Manhattan apartment that he shared with his wife, Yoko Ono, and five-year-old son, Sean. Mark David Chapman, a 25-year-old from Fort Worth, Texas, was arrested yards from where the murder took place, holding a copy of J.B. Salinger's book, The Catcher in the Rye. Chapman told police that he had acted alone. Subsequently, Chapman pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to a prison term of 20 years to life with a stipulation that mental health treatment would be provided. And he may have had the same kind of mental health treatment that Jack Ruby got in prison. More about that later. About the quote, mental health treatment. I would note that Chapman was in Attica Prison, as we looked at in For the Record programs 314 and 315. quote, Indian country, unquote, the Mohawk Mother's Trail of Tears. Attica has links to the behavior modification programs initiated by the Rockefellers, including MKUltra and related programs. Again, that is discussed in For the Record programs 314 and 315. Resuming with this narrative, again, from the article by Jeremy Kuznarov, Covert Action Magazine, December 8th, 2023. Over the decades, Chapman has given conflicting reasons for why he killed Lennon, citing his spiritual beliefs, meaning Chapman's, his own desire to become famous, and even that killing Lennon would help promote Catcher in the Rye. Problem with the official story? And a CIA connection. That's the next section of the article. There is one major problem with the story of Chapman as Lennon's lone assassin. Lennon was struck by four bullets on the left side of his body when Chapman was on his right side. One more time. There is one major problem with the story of Chapman as Lennon's lone assassin. Lennon was struck by four bullets on the left side of his body when Chapman was on his right side. There was a man who was standing on Lennon's left when Lennon was shot, the doorman. He was identified in 1987 by People Magazine's James Gaines, G-A-I-N-E-S, as Jose Sanjenis Perdomo. Sanjenis, capital S-A-N-J-E-N-I-S. I may be mispronouncing that. Perdomo is capital P-E-R-D-O-M-O. One more time. He was identified in 1987 by People Magazine's James Gaines as Jose Sanjenis Perdomo, an anti-Castro sniper who was part of the CIA's Cuban exile invasion of Cuba in April of 1961. In pre-Castro Cuba, Perdomo had been a chief of police under the regime of Carlos Prios and dictator Fidencio Batista. Allegedly, he helped coordinate a CIA assassination squad in Cuba and was the control officer the CIA assigned to Frank Sturgis when Sturgis joined the CIA in 1958. Sturgis was involved in both the JFK assassination and Watergate break-in. If the CIA were behind Lennon's death, its motive was clear. Lennon was an icon of the 1960s peace movement who was planning to revitalize his music career and could inspire a regeneration of the peace and progressive activism in the 1980s to counter the Reagan Revolution. And continuing. In the 1970s, the FBI had carried out a large-scale surveillance operation against Lennon, who was also targeted by the CIA's Operation Chaos. Lennon was feared because he funded financially troubled underground newspapers, sang songs for social justice, and supported radical causes, including an organization that registered young voters opposed to the Vietnam War. The FBI attempted to get municipal police to arrest Lennon on drug charges. British MI5 also targeted him because of his support for the Irish Republican Army, or IRA. The U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, or INS, tried to have Lennon deported in a campaign spearheaded by former Dixiecrat Senator Strom Thurmond, Republican of South Carolina. On the eve of Lennon's death, once John and Yoko left for John's last recording session at about 4 p.m., Perdomo spent the next 6.5 hours chatting with Chapman. What about? One can only surmise. Again, note this. On the evening of Lennon's death, once John and Yoko left for John's last recording session at about 4 p.m., Perdomo spent the next 6.5 hours chatting with Chapman. What about? One can only surmise. Yes, indeed, one can only surmise. It's difficult not to conclude that somehow that long chatting with Mark David Chapman was involved with the assassination. You know, in some way presenting it. Q, who knows? Typically, it is crucial for the establishment of guilt or innocence that the police conduct forensic tests of the bullets or a gun, which in the case of Lennon's murder, they did not do. One more time. Typically, it is crucial for the establishment of guilt or innocence that the police conduct forensic tests of the gun or bullets, which in the case of Lemon's murder, they did not do. After Chapman dropped his gun, Perdomo ordered elevator operator Joseph Mammy to pick up the gun and bring it to a storage room downstairs. It was then removed, but no fingerprint tests were taken by the police, though care was taken to preserve the fingerprints from the copy of the Catcher in the Rye that Chapman had been holding and dropped when the police arrived. One of the first police officers at the murder scene, Peter Cullen, believed that the handyman had pulled the trigger, but Perdomo convinced him otherwise. A witness pointed to the left side of Lemon, saying, quote, "He's the one that did the shooting," unquote, referring to Perdomo. One more time. British author David Whalen, W-H-E-L-A-N, who spent 3 years researching John Lennon's death, emphasized that in the official story, Chapman shot Lennon from 25 feet away when the medical reports made clear that the bullets entered Lennon from close quarters. 25 feet is a vast distance for an untrained marksman like Chapman. Dr. David Halloran, who treated Lennon, stated, quote, "Not even the Navy SEAL could pull it off at that distance," unquote. Lieutenant Arthur O'Connor, who grilled Chapman in the police precinct, said that Chapman clearly had not committed the murder to make himself famous, as he, quote, "didn't want to talk to the press from the very start," unquote, and was, quote, "apprehensive about his wife finding out from the media." O'Connor said that Chapman, quote, "did not want the notoriety. He did not want the glory of a trial either," unquote, adding significantly that, quote, "it's possible Mark could not have been used," one more time. O'Connor said that Chapman, quote, "did not want the notoriety. He did not want the glory of a trial either," unquote, adding significantly that, quote, "it's possible Mark could have been used by somebody. I saw him the night of the murder. I studied him intensely. It looked as if he could have been programmed." And the next section, was Chapman a Manchurian candidate? According to author Fenton Bresler, Mark David Chapman resembled Saran Saran, the patsy in the RFK assassination, in meeting all the criteria for having been pre-programmed and brainwashed. After Lennon's killing, Chapman was found calmly reading J.B. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye and surrendered to the NYPD meekly when there was a subway 75 feet away and he could have easily escaped. One more time. After Lennon's killing, Chapman was found calmly reading J.B. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye and surrendered to the NYPD meekly when there was a subway 75 feet away and he could have easily escaped. Chapman had become obsessed with The Catcher in the Rye, casting himself as the book's lead character, Holden Caulfield, inscribing a note in his copy of the book to Holden Caulfield from Holden Caulfield, unquote. Chapman's manufactured obsession with The Catcher in the Rye was clearly crucial to the whole operation. Not only was the goal to kill a leading icon of the 1960s movement, which the CIA wanted crushed, but it was also to try to associate Lennon with the phoniness of the adult world that Holden Caulfield, another icon of the 1960s movement, disdained. Chapman directly referred to Lennon as a phony, stating, quote, "He told us to imagine no possessions" in his 1971 song Imagine, and there he was with millions of dollars and yachts and farms and country estates, laughing at people like me who had believed the lies and bought the records and built a big part of their lives around his music, unquote. Chapman's denigration of Lemon fit well with the campaign and popular literature to portray hippies as hypocritical narcissists and anti-war activists as having spat upon Vietnam veterans when few, if any, such incidents actually took place. The effect was to help shift American political culture to the right and prevent the reemergence of youthful rebellion in the 1980s as C. Wright Mills' power elite, unquote, desired. Note the following. In Attica Prison, Chapman received the best accommodations of any prisoner, suggesting that there were powerful people protecting him. He was visited by ministers of the fundamentalist Christian church to which he belonged, who doubled as U.S. military intelligence officers. Chapman had converted to evangelical Christianity in 1971 after a period of heavy use of mind-altering drugs. He had rebelled against his abusive father, David Curtis Chapman, a staff sergeant in the U.S. Air Force who worked for the American Oil Corporation, or AMOCO. In his book, Careless Genius, John Lennon and His Maternal Demon, Anthony Granowitz emphasizes that Chapman's conversion from drug abuse to Christian fundamentalism made him a suitable target for the command hallucination he may have experienced. New religious converts are considered easy to manipulate because their conversation is associated with a heightened emotional state. According to UC Berkeley professor Richard Offshead, after the formal termination of the CIA's Operation MKUltra in 1973, the operation continued to be carried out secretly through religious cults. MKUltra involved mind control and brainwashing experiments that the CIA carried out in an attempt to manipulate, condition, and control people. RFK's assassin, Saran Saran, is believed to have been hypnotized under MKUltra and programmed into an assassin who was set up as a patsy. His trigger appeared to be a woman in the polka dot dress, and he appeared, like Chapman, to be calm after the killing and dissociated from the evil in which he had participated. A person linking Saran and Chapman is Bernard Diamond, a forensic psychiatrist who hypnotized Saran and testified at his trial and also visited Chapman in prison. Chapman was also visited by Milton Kline, K-L-I-N-E, another expert hypnotist and CIA consultant who once said he could, quote, create a patsy in 3 months, unquote, and, quote, an assassin in 6 months. Unquote. Again, this is very interesting, and I'm going to reread this. A person linking Saran and Chapman is Bernard Diamond, a forensic psychiatrist who hypnotized Saran and testified at his trial and also visited Chapman in prison. Chapman was also visited by Milton Kline, another expert hypnotist and CIA consultant, who once said he could create a patsy in 3 months, unquote, and an assassin in 6 months, unquote. And by the way, we went into Bernard Diamond and the links to the assassination of Robert Kennedy in AFA program number 6, the third of 3 AFA programs about mind control. Returning to the article. In 1975, Chapman worked for the YMCA in Beirut. In Inside the Company, a CIA diary, Philip Agee recounts how, when he worked for the CIA in Ecuador in 1962, his cover was as manager of the Quito YMCA, where he managed the YMCA basketball team. Lebanon, at the time Chapman was there, was the first Middle Eastern nation to request U.S. troops under its rightist Christian president to crush a mostly leftist Muslim uprising. After his return to the U.S., Chapman was flown to Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, to assist David C. Moore, the new director for the reeducation and resettlement of anti-communist Vietnamese refugees. After a trip around the world, he settled in Hawaii, a place with a strong U.S. military presence. He joined, this next one is very interesting, he joined a small music club in which John W. Hinckley, who tried to assassinate President Ronald Reagan on March 30th, 1981, was already a member. Hinckley Jr. was connected with the Bush family. He had allegedly helped George W. Bush in an unsuccessful campaign for Congress in 1978, and his brother Scott, president of Vanderbilt Energy Corporation, a company allegedly bailed out by Vice President George H.W. Bush's Zapata Oil, was scheduled to have dinner with Neil Bush, Bush's son, the night after the assassination attempt. John Hinckley Sr., the founder of Vanderbilt Energy Corporation, had also raised funds for George H.W. Bush's political campaigns and financed an evangelical charity, World Vision International, that served as a cover for CIA operations. All these latter coincidences are just too much. Chapman's ties to Hinckley and Hinckley's ties to Bush a CIA director in 1975 who had worked as an undercover CIA asset in the 1960s, point to the likelihood of their involvement in a conspiracy that connects the murder of John Lennon and Reagan assassination attempt and was designed to shift the political landscape during the 1980s. And the next article is very, the next section of the article is really interesting. And again, with regard to John Hinckley, the inclusion of both Hinckley and Mark David Chapman, neither of whom I think were the assassins that were made out to be. I think Hinckley was a diversion, a patsy, and it's pretty clear that Chapman was. But the notion that they would have been part of the same music club in Hawaii, that is really asking an awful lot. And remember that John Hinckley was a member of the American Nazi Party, actually the American National Socialist White People's Party. The director of that organization at the time said he was suspected of being a federal agent. But one of the things that's interesting about the assassination of JFK is that the alleged leftist Lee Harvey Oswald not only had George Lincoln Rockwell's Arlington, Virginia name and address in his address book, but that of Daniel Burroughs as well, another member of the American Nazi Party. George Lincoln Rockwell was shot and killed in 1967, just as Jim Garrison's investigation was gathering steam. And also, Daniel Burroughs allegedly committed suicide, but in the book The Klan by Patsy Sims, it is mentioned that Daniel Burroughs allegedly committed suicide at the farm of Pennsylvania, the leader of the Pennsylvania Ku Klux Klan, the Grand Dragon, I believe his title was, and that was, I'm forgetting his name off the top of my head. It will come to me later in the article, later on in the program, if not afterward. But again, he was the, Roy Frankhauser, that was his name. Roy Frankhauser was the head of the Pennsylvania Klan. He also had worked as a contract agent for the CIA and NSA. By the way, contract agent doesn't mean that he took out contracts on people, though he may have. It means that rather than being a career employee of the agencies, he simply signed on to do a particular job. However, as he noted with regard to the, quote, suicide, unquote, of Daniel Burroughs, quote, bad case of suicide, three bullets. That's what they said, though. Again, a three-bullet suicide is a very, very bad case of suicide indeed. But do note that this remarkable degree of overlap between Mark David Chapman and John W. Hinckley, as set forth here or as alleged by Jeremy Kuznarov. And again, the shooting of Ronald Reagan, who was the number two man poised right behind him to take control of the White House if Reagan was fatally wounded? That was none other than George H.W. Bush. By the way, among the programs dealing with the shooting of Ronald Reagan, for the record, 244 goes into that as at a considerable length. It excerpts a miscellaneous archive show. Resuming with the article. All these latter coincidences are just too much. Yes, indeed they are. Chapman's ties to Hinckley and Hinckley's ties to Bush, CIA director in 1975, who worked as an undercover CIA asset in the 1960s, point to the likelihood of their involvement in a conspiracy that connects the murder of John Lennon and the Reagan assassination attempt and was designed to shift the political landscape during the 1980s. And the next section, I think, in many ways is, well, I wouldn't say the most important, but one of the most important. Again, I've always wondered about Yoko Ono. I'm not a big fan of hers. In the pictures of the two of them together, her eyes always struck me as, well, just very interesting eyes. And Yoko Ono was also the step great granddaughter, I think, direct step descendant of the founder of the Yasuda Trust, again, along with Sumitomo Mitsui and Mitsubishi, the four great zaibatsu that were the engine of Japanese industry and finance, and that, basically were the drivers of, the Japanese war economy. And for the record, 905, we excerpted a miscellaneous archive show, about, the zaibatsu, and, we accessed the remarkable work of George Sobeys in his book, Facts and Fascism. More about Yoko Ono and the Yasuda Trust later on. Suspicion cast on Yoko Ono. According to Granowitz, Lenin's widow Yoko Ono's behavior was very suspicious around the time of the assassination. She had his body cremated on December 10th, a mere 36 hours after Lenin was shot. If in fact, as it appears, Lenin was shot four times in the left side of his body, whereas Hakley was standing to the right, that certainly an autopsy would have been very, very revealing about the real nature of the assassination. However, with his body being cremated 36 hours after the killing, that was apparently not possible. Certainly, it is interesting, shall we say, if not suspicious, that Yoko Ono had the body cremated 36 hours after the killing. In the book Careless Genius, Anthony Granowitz depicts Ono as a manipulative woman who cashed in on Lenin's death by taking charge of his estate and forcing family members to buy back some of Lenin's artifacts. By 2022, Ono's fortune had grown to $700 million. An upper-class heiress, Ono was the great-granddaughter of the founder of the Bank of Tokyo, Shinhiro Yasuda. Her father was appointed president of the Bank of Tokyo in New York, and she attended Sarah Lawrence College, among the most expensive U.S. colleges. Prior to John's death, the marriage with Yoko was heading to divorce, according to Granowitz. Yoko was 8 years older than John and cast a maternal spell on him that was beginning to dissipate. The two began living separately, and Yoko was using heroin. Granowitz writes that Ono, unable to compete musically with her famous and talented husband, grew jealous and resentful. After taking some time off to raise their son, Sean, Lennon was poised to put out a new album and resurrect his career, while Yoko, whose art career was floundering, would be left behind. John was also resuming his political activism, traveling to the West Coast to support the Japanese workers' strike against the Japan Foods Corporation, or JPC, whose dynastic owners were peers of Ono's family. Granowitz sees political significance in Ono's standing by Chicago's Mayor Rahm Emanuel in June of 2015, as he announced the restoration of a Shinto temple that had been burned down in retaliation for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Shintoism had served as the state religion in fascist Japan and was employed to justify the vast number of Japanese atrocities. One more time. Granowitz sees political significance in Ono's standing by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel in June of 2015 as he announced the restoration of a Shinto temple that had been burned down in retaliation for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Shintoism had served as a state religion in fascist Japan and was employed to justify the vast number of Japanese atrocities. Granowitz writes that Ono's actions, quote, fit in well with Washington's rehabilitation of Japan to counterbalance the growing power of China. By the way, Rahm Emanuel had links to former President Barack Obama, whose own heritage tracks back to the brutal coup in Indonesia, as we've spoken about in past programs and part of the series, called The Narco-Fascism of Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang. And again, very interesting that Ono would be rubbing elbows with Rahm Emanuel as he announced the restoration of the Shinto temple that had been burned down in retaliation for the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And as Granowitz knows, Granowitz writes that Ono's actions, quote, fit in well with Washington's rehabilitation of Japan to counterbalance the growing power of China. If Yoko was involved in the plot to kill Lennon, Grunewitz suggests that it would have been through Samuel Havitpoy, H-E-V-A-B-P-O-Y, an antique beaver and Ono's interior decorator and landlord, who had moved in with her particularly through his attorney, Leon Dicker, who had been arrested in 1986 for gunrunning on behalf of the CIA-backed dictator of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos, who had been plotting a comeback coup after he was overthrown by a popular revolution. Grunewitz concludes his book by writing the quote, "Lennon's death signified that an upper-class heiress had triumphed over a working-class genius. Ono knew she had the intelligence agencies and the political establishment of Japan and the United States squarely behind her," unquote. Once more time. Grunewitz concludes his book by writing that, quote, "Lennon's death signified that an upper-class heiress had triumphed over a working-class genius. Ono knew she had the intelligence agencies and the political establishment of Japan and the United States squarely behind her," unquote. Whether Ono portrayed Lennon and had anything to do with his murder is, of course, speculative. Grunewitz's book proposes the theory. It does not prove it. The evidence strongly indicates, however, that there was a conspiracy, that Chapman was not the killer but set up as a patsy like Saran Saran, and before him Lee Harvey Oswald, and that Perdomo was the real killer, indicating that the CIA was behind it. The loss was ultimately all of humanity's. Future generations were deprived of the music that would have come from Lennon's genius. Lennon also might have helped revitalize the peace and justice movements of the 1960s and inspired new generations of activists, blunting the growth of the conservative political order that has led to widening social inequality, environmental degradation, and an era of endless war. Well, as I've said so often, well, it's not certainly original with me, but in matters political, one wants to follow the money. And we're going to read some excerpts from the book The Yamato Dynasty, one of the many brilliant books by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. This is copyright 1999 by Broadway Books, a division of Random House. And again, The Yamato Dynasty, the hardcover edition. And we're going to read some excerpts of that book right now. On pages 228 and 229, bear in mind that Yoko Ono was the step-great-granddaughter of the founder of the Yasuda Trust. That puts her right smack dab in the middle of the Japanese power structure, and that in turn was inextricably linked with the American power structure as well. And recapping some information about the links between big American money and big Japanese money, reading from the Yamato Dynasty. "Imprudently, the American bureaucrats who drafted FEC 230 foolishly overlooked the vested interests of major U.S. banks and corporations that had made huge pre-war loans and investments in Japan. Morgan Bank had provided Japan with many loans, including one of $150 million to rebuild Tokyo after the Kanto earthquake, and the Japanese government had defaulted on repayment of all these loans at the time of Pearl Harbor. Many other U.S. corporations had major pre-war stakes in Japan in the form of loans and direct investments. At the end of 1941, American investment accounted for three-quarters of the total foreign capital in Japanese industry. The largest single direct investment, nearly half of the total, was by General Electric, one of the Morgan extended family. GE held 16% of the paid-up capital of Tokyo Shibara Electric, a firm linked to the Mitsui Zaibatsu. Other large investments had been made by Associated Oil in Mitsubishi Petroleum, by Westinghouse in Mitsubishi Electric, by Owens Libby in Sumitomo, by American Can in Mitsui, and so on. After the war, these U.S. corporations were owed reparations, royalties, and loan payments totaling more than $1 billion. They were determined not only to recover their investments, but to resume their profitable business operations in Japan. If Japan's biggest conglomerates were broken up, this would impact directly on their American partners. and more from the Imapa dynasty. This new rationale was taking hold in Washington and being echoed in Tokyo, thanks to careful orchestration. Japanese government spokesman said that SCAP, that was the U.S. government governing body in Japan, was persecuting businessmen not because they had committed war crimes or acquired their wealth by illegal means, but because they had been successful. Quote, we find it difficult to understand how this can be democracy. The empire's key financial and industrial figures, the men we need most to provide a sound business development upon which real democracy must rest, are being condemned without trial merely because they were businessmen, unquote. The old guard in the Diet, and that was the Japanese parliament, echoing Joseph Gru. He was a Morgan protege and the U.S. ambassador to Japan for many years, predicted, quote, chaos and confusion, unquote, and communist revolution in Japan if these purges went ahead. And still more from the Yamato dynasty. In Washington, a group known as the Japan Crowd encouraged these reversals of SCAP policy. Joseph Gru was their spokesman, guided by Herbert Hoover as well as Thomas Lamont, who had raised a generation of investment bankers to share his view of China as a corrupt place and Japan as a nation of fiscal self-discipline. After the war, Gru retired from his post as Undersecretary of State and moved to Wall Street, where he became the leading lobbyist of the Japan Crowd. By 1947, America's Republican Party was in full resurgence. Democracies were on the defensive. SCAP reforms were being aborted, and all talk of purges and retribution in Japan was silenced. Gru and the Japan Crowd prevailed because now success in China and communist challenges in Korea, Vietnam, Indonesia, and elsewhere alarmed even liberal politicians, persuading them of the need to build an iron triangle of Japan, Taiwan, and Korea. And that's still more. Conservative American business leaders were usually careful to denounce monopolies and cartels in principle, but they successfully fought off any effort to break up Japan's conglomerates in practice. Gru and his colleagues made all the right democratic noises about reforming post-war Japan while working energetically behind the scenes to block all efforts at reform. These men believed that the best hope for the future Pacific economy lay in reviving pre-war trade patterns, with America again becoming Japan's biggest trading partner. Japan had the only massive industrial base in Asia. Once its financial elite were fully restored to positions of control, Japan would become an industrial bulwark against further expansion of communism in Asia. The time frame was urgent. Gru also became co-chairman of a new lobbying group, the American Council on Japan, or ACJ. The ACJ was a political action committee set up by wealthy American conservatives immediately after the war to lobby Washington and to fight the initiatives on reforming Japan that were being championed by liberals, whom the ACJ scathingly referred to as, quote, New Deal Democrats, unquote, and communist fellow travelers, unquote. In the summer of 1947, again reading from the Yamato Dynasty, in the summer of 1947, Harriman associate James Lee Kaufman visited Tokyo on behalf of Dillon Reed and made a personal assessment of the Truman administration's secret plan for the breakup of the Zaibatsu. That would include Yasuda Zaibatsu, with which Yoko Ono was obviously familiarly affiliated. The secret FEC 230 documents were then leaked to Newsweek by Undersecretary of the Army William Draper, in civilian life a senior partner of Dillon Reed. In December of 1947, while America was gearing up for its presidential election campaign, Newsweek began a series of articles denouncing SCAP 1. The magazine accused SCAP of running amok and exceeding its authority. SCAP was trying to impose, quote, an economic theory which has no counterpart anywhere else in the world. It is not communistic, but it is far to the left of anything tolerated in this country. Newsweek went on to warn American taxpayers that this plan posed grave dangers to their wallets. Quote, Japan is costing the American taxpayers millions of dollars a year. Breaking up the Zaibatsu would, quote, weaken the Japanese economy to the point where the maintenance of Japan would become a continual charge on the American taxpayer, unquote. It was vital, Pakenham said, to get Japan back on track and make it a, quote, fertile field of American capital, unquote. In the immediate post-war scramble for reparations, the Japanese zaibatsu, including the wealthy, still reading from the, Yamato Dynasty. In the immediate post-war scramble for reparations, the Japanese zaibatsu, including the wealthy families toward whom Truman advisor Edwin Pauly was so sympathetic, and who, like post-war Prime Minister Panaka, for example, had profited enormously from the war and hid their profits, submitted their own claims for compensation for wartime damages to their armaments factories. These claims came to more than $5 billion, and many were paid. By the way, this is in the immediate post-World War II period. $5 billion was a whole lot of money. It's a nice chunk of change today, but man, back then it was huge. One more time. These claims came to more than $5 billion, and many were paid. Compare that to the $1 billion paid to victims. Instead of cash payments to conquered countries, Japan was ordered to send industrial equipment. Even these token reparations were suspended by Washington when the equipment was claimed as collateral for bonds issued before the war by American firms, including Morgan Bank and Dillon Reed, who were at the head of a long line of U.S. corporations with big pre-war investments in Japan. By the early 1950s, Japan owed Morgan nearly $600 million in unpaid interest, penalties, and principal just for the 1924 earthquake loan. This did not include other huge sums for other loans that Morgan and members of its extended family had made before 1940. In 1951, an official from Japan's Ministry of Finance arrived at Morgan headquarters at 23 Wall Street, saying, quote, "I have come to honor my signature," unquote. At this time, no Japanese bureaucrat had the power to make such a statement. 1951, by the way, was the year that Alan Dulles chaperoned either one, the 1951, quote, peace treaty, unquote, against which, by the way, the late Iris Chang lobbied. Not obviously for its inclusion, she wasn't born then, but she spoke out against that. One more time. In 1951, an official from Japan's Ministry of Finance arrived at Morgan headquarters at 23 Wall Street saying, quote, "I have come to honor my signature," unquote. At this time, no Japanese bureaucrat had the power to make such a statement. Japan was still an occupied country, and nothing of this sort could have been said without the explicit approval of General MacArthur. In any event, the official went on to say that Japan had not defaulted on a loan in 2,000 years. Refinancing and servicing was arranged through Smith Barney and Guarantee Trust. Smith Barney had already joined the Morgan family when it suffered financial reversals during the Depression, and Guarantee Trust had been a Morgan, quote, ward, unquote, since the 1920s. Thus, Morgan not only benefited from getting its loans repaid, but by having its subsidiaries collect commissions for restructuring the same loans. In the end, there was nothing fair about the way Japan's acknowledged post-war resources were allocated. People who were physically the victims of Japanese brutality were completely upstaged by big corporations that commandeered all the money made available. By 1952, Tokyo had repaid all pre-war investments by United States corporations and compensated them for all property damage, so these American firms made a profit on the war even in Japan. And noting here... once again, from the Yamato Dynasty, America's oligarchs had rescued Japan's oligarchs. Although it was absurd to see the Pacific War only as a minor historical aberration, they were intent upon restoring things in Japan as they were before the war. George Keenan said, quote, "We had purposely relieved our erstwhile opponents of every shred of responsibility for what was now to come," unquote. The elite simply tucked the bitter pill in their cheek to spit it out the moment the Americans were gone. And again, note that, as Seagate put it, America's oligarchs had rescued Japan's oligarchs. And a little more about that, and about the cosmetic renaming of the Yasuda Bank, again from the Yamato Dynasty. In February of 1948, the American government sent two Wall Street bankers to Japan to decide whether liberal reforms should go ahead or not. The outcome was predictable. The Draper Johnston mission, led by banker Percy Johnston and Undersecretary of the Army William Draper, by the way, Percy Johnston also became Truman's Secretary of State, Assistant Secretary of Defense, I believe it was. The Draper Johnston mission, led by banker Percy Johnston and Undersecretary of the Army William Draper, spent 2 weeks in Japan, then announced its recommendations. Draper knew little about Japan, but as he was on leave from his position as a vice president of Dillon Reed, it was only natural that he was anxious to protect his investments and those of related firms. Earlier, he had made a name for himself by rescuing German industry from the, quote, excessive zeal, unquote, of U.S. occupation forces in Europe. Percy Johnston was an executive of New York's Chemical Bank, which had long-standing ties with Mitsui Bank. So this was like sending foxes to inventory the henhouse. What Japan really needed, they said, was not to be punished for waging a merciless war, but to be restored to economic power as quickly as possible. The Japanese themselves could not have said it better. Of the original list of 325 Japanese companies that were to be reorganized, only 20 remained on the Draper-Johnston list. No Japanese banks were to be restructured. The ambitious American plan to reform Japan's economy and government was suffocated in the cradle in less than 3 years. As a precaution, the great Zaibatsu banks did change their names for a while. Mitsubishi Bank temporarily became Chiyoda Bank, Sumitomo Bank became Osaka Bank, Yasuda Bank became Fuji Bank, and so on. The boom brought about by the Korean War in 1950 to 1953 quickly returned them to profitability and made it possible to resurface their carefully hidden assets without attracting attention. Prime Minister Yoshida called the Korean War, quote, a gift from the gods, unquote. And note that the Yasuda Bank and the Yasuda Zaibatsu of the Yasuda Trust was the interest with which Yoko Ono was affiliated. She was the step-great-granddaughter of the founder of that bank and had strong links to Japanese capital. And again, as noted in the article about the assassination of John Lennon by Jeremy Kuznarov, Granowitz concludes his book by writing that Lennon's death signified that an upper-class heiress had triumphed over a working-class genius. Ono knew that she had the intelligence agencies and the political establishment of Japan and the United States squarely behind her, unquote. Whether Ono betrayed Lennon and had anything to do with his murder is, of course, speculative. Granowitz's book proposes the theory. It does not prove it. The evidence strongly indicates, however, that there was a conspiracy. That Chapman was not the killer, but set up as a patsy like Saran Saran, and before him Lee Harvey Oswald, and that Perdomo was the real killer, indicating that the CIA was behind it. The loss was ultimately all of humanities. Future generations were deprived of the music that would... Anyway, I was not a big fan of John Lennon. I'm still not. I like the Beatles' earlier music better than their later stuff, but that's, you know, obviously completely subjective. He was an icon, and he was a political activist. He actually financed the 3 articles in the Realist magazine by my late dear friend named Russell. And he was certainly a politically involved individual. But again, I've always found Yoko Ono's presence, shall we say, around John Lennon to be, quote, interesting, unquote. I never liked the look in her eyes. And when I found out that she was basically from the same family as the founder of the Yasuda Trust, that began to make a whole... That certainly provided a whole different perspective on things. Again, as noted here, Granowitz does not prove that Ono was involved. He suggests it. But again, she certainly was involved, as noted here. Lennon's death signified that an upper-class heiress had triumphed over a working-class genius. Ono knew she had the intelligence agencies and the political establishment of Japan and the U.S. squarely behind her, unquote. Well, yes, she did. And that is indicated in the excerpts from the Yamato Dynasty that I have read, and they will be in the written description for the program. Do bear in mind that at the top of each written for-the-record description and at the top of each Food for Thought post, there are links to, A, the podcast of For the Record being made by sister station WFMU. So podcasting is the best way for you to consume For the Record. WFMU is basically podcasting For the Record. And also there was a link to the 32-gigabyte flash drive that is available with all of my work, both printed and recorded on it. And that is available for a nominal tax-deductible contribution. I get no money whatsoever from that. Perhaps proof that my worst critic's assertions that I'm insane is perhaps not altogether fanciful. And again, please check the Food for Thought post that is currently, by the way, also get in the habit of checking regularly the comments made by Parafractal, our brilliant contributing editor. They are an enormous resource in and of themselves, so many comments. Anyway, do check the For the Record description at the top of the SpitfireList.com website for information about program policy, etc. going forward. This concludes For the Record program number 1321, The Assassination of John Lennon. This is being recorded on February 23rd of the year 2024. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.